Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
What was the reason for going back to have the baby? Was it medical care, just issues of citizenship or concerns? What was the concern?
So my wife had originally planned on having the baby in Peru, and she had found a doctor who had been trained in the U.S. and was very competent. She really liked him. But when we finally got down to see the hospital, the level of like nursing care and technology, and said basically, if something goes wrong, the ability to deal with it down here may not be as well. And then Cheryl Green was the nurse practitioner down there at the time. She said, hey, listen, we recommend that you go back. And not only that, we'll pay for you to go back and have the baby. So my in-laws were living up in Vermont, running a country store up in Stowe, Vermont at the time. And my oldest daughter is a Vermont woodchuck now. So she's born in Vermont.
I spoke at a conference up in Vermont one time, and I flew in, and I'm driving up there, and I stop at this little country store. I mean, it's beautiful up there, obviously. And I was laughing. Somebody said, what are you laughing about? I turned around, and I saw this T-shirt, and it had a picture of a maple tree on there. And it said, yeah, I'd tap that.
Yeah.
I started laughing.
Well, you're talking about a land where there are more cows than there are people, right? So
yes, there are. Yeah. But man, beautiful. Spoke out at this place that was next to a ski resort, and just beautiful up there. Well, so let's talk about that. So they come back, but let's talk about your work then. You had culture shock going to Ohio. Was there a culture shock in Peru, or were you more aligned with what was going on down there?
So I had done a crash course in Spanish. The government was very generous and gave me 10 weeks of Spanish language training, and I didn't really have to do any other work. So it was 6 hours a day of Spanish language training and 3 hours of homework. And then when I wasn't doing that, I was like sort of trying to assimilate and learn as much as I could about Peruvian culture and the Peruvian drug trafficking scene and that sort of thing. And even with all of the lead-in time and the preparation, it was shocking when you arrive. The disparity between the wealth that was there in the neighborhood where I lived and the poverty in much of the country, just something I had never seen before. I'd never really been outside of the country before. I mean, other than Canada or, you know. And it's, you know, the Atacama Desert that runs along the coast where Lima is one of the driest in the world. And, you know, you get a fraction of an inch of rain a year over there. They have something called Garua where the rain just sort of hangs in the air. So the whole place it looks like a cat litter box, you know, sand everywhere. And if they don't irrigate, you don't really have a whole lot of foliage. And yet I live in this place called Casuarinas, which is on these beautiful slopes and hills, and it's all irrigated with palm trees and swimming pools and these big luxurious homes. And as it turns out, my house overlooks the house of a guy named Tito Lopez Paredes, who's one of the biggest drug dealers in all of Peru. His family lived there. As it turns out, he didn't spend much time with his family. But, you know, you're living like that, and then you look off into the hills, and they had something called Pueblos Jóvenes, which basically means young towns. And people were living in structures that were made out of woven reed mats that often didn't even have a roof on them because they didn't get enough rain that was a problem. It was just like privacy walls on the outside. they would sink a well for the community, but they didn't have running water in their house, and they might have, you know, strung up some wires enough to like hang a naked light bulb, you know, cooking on a propane stove. It was remarkable, the disparity. I'd never seen anything like that, and it was definitely a culture shock.
It was the same way in Colombia when we got there. There was no middle class. It was either a have or a have not type situation. Unbelievable.
Now, was your, at the time when they put you in that house, were you aware that the biggest dope dealer, you know, would live right down the street from you, or was that something you found out about later?
I found out much later about that when we heard like gunshots, you know, and that turned out to be
just... This is your
captain.
This is your first indication shit's about to happen. Gunfire.
Well, you know, everybody had armed guards in their place, and the other thing they had was roof dogs, so that you would get these real nasty dogs, and they lived on the roof so the burglars couldn't climb the fence or drop on there. And they had, you know, vicious dogs on the roof that they would give just enough food and water to keep them alive. But you didn't want to go wandering into somebody's house or, you know, uninvited. You'd get yourself torn up pretty good.
That's the first time I ever heard of that.
Yeah, no, that was a big thing there. Roof dogs, Peruvian roof dogs. And then the worst thing was the cars. So, it was so difficult to earn enough money to buy a car that if you owned a car, you thought you owned the road as well. And if your horn didn't work, the car was not serviceable. You couldn't drive it because the horn had to be going at all times while you're driving. Just
wait,
crazy.
You're talking about Orlando.
That or New York. That sounds like New York. Out of my way. Out of my way.
Yeah, no, it was thrilling. And, you know, at the time we had Operation Snowcap had just kicked off. So that was an operation that was geared towards going to the source of the cocaine trade. Of course, Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia were the ground zero for the global cocaine trade. And
Talk about that for a second, too, because we were talking about some other folks and talking about actually with one of our guys, too. We interviewed the son of the Cali cartel leader. We talked to William Rodriguez. But it's interesting, too, because people think everything emanated out of Colombia, but you got to have the pace first. You got to have the other stuff that gets going into there, right? So talk about that a little bit. Set the stage for what it really means when you got the global cocaine trade. That's why Peru, places like that, are so important.
Yeah. So circa 1987, when we started this operation, Peru was actually the single largest source for the raw material, the coca paste. And I'll explain what that means. Even bigger than Colombia, what was happening was there's a shrub. It basically looks like the kind of shrub you would plant along your house that produces a leaf, the coca leaf. And then that leaf is called a maceration pit, but it's basically ground up, put some fuel in there and float the alkaloid out. And then it's washed in a process to turn it from coca paste to cocaine base. And then the base was all flown off to Colombia, where these labs would refine it into cocaine hydrochloride, the drug of choice for a lot of addicts that were using it in the United States. But the actual raw material, most of it at that point, was coming out of Peru. And
hey, Tony, real quick, why, just out of curiosity, because we actually, when we had Michelle Linhart on, one of her big cases was a huge paste dealer, I think, out of that area. But why didn't, was it just because of the structure of the way the cartels work? Why didn't Peru just get an idea, go, hey, look, we got the materials here. Why don't we just take the materials, produce our own cocaine, and cut the Colombians out?
Yeah. So, so she was working on a case in Bolivia at the time. I remember this case because I later went on to run the office in Bolivia. But, the production of cocaine is extraordinarily labor intensive. Like, nobody who had other options would, for the money that they make at that part of the distribution chain, would do the work required to harvest coca plants and turn those leaves into coca paste if you had any other way to make money. It, you know, we talk about like a, you know, this multi-billion dollar global industry that generates huge amounts of money, but at the bottom of the of the pyramid, the campesinos who are cultivating the coca plant, picking the leaves, drying the leaves, hauling them to a maceration pit, decantation pit, and then trying to like just turn this into a paste to do it, they're earning nothing. I mean, at the time back then, I think they were earning $400 to $600 a kilo for coca paste. And it took 7 kilos of coca paste to make 1 kilo of cocaine. So, you know, they were not making the millions of dollars. They weren't living the Don Johnson Miami Vice lifestyle down there. These people were working really physically demanding jobs in terrible places to eke out a subsistence that. You know, and so it was really driven as much, well, two things, geography and poverty. So the woody shrub that produces the coca plant, the coca leaf for cocaine, will grow in a lot of places, but it will only produce high levels of anthraxylene coca, the alkaloid that they make cocaine from, if it's got altitude it's altitude, certain amount of precipitation in the year, and soil types, and the ideal locations for that are along the eastern slope of the Andes, where you know, the weather comes in and it dumps a lot of rain, but you're up at high elevations and it's got good drainage. And so it not only grows the coca leaf, but it grows very high concentrations of the alkaloid that you need to make the cocaine. And so they didn't really have sophisticated traffickers back in those days in Peru anyway, who were capable of like managing the international markets and understood how to refine this and get it to market. All they were doing is producing the raw materials to somebody else that was willing to buy them. And yet, when I got there in 87, we would fly over the mountains, over the Andes, land in a little place called Tingo Maria, and then jump on the helicopters and fly up the Alto Huayaga Valley. And for an hour to an hour and a half flight, there was no point for an hour and a half where you couldn't look out of the helicopter in any direction and see coca under cultivation. I mean, it was for somebody who had been buying it by the ounce and, you know, thrilled when you seized a kilo, it's like, holy crap, we are, you know, we're up against something that I really had not understood until I went down there. This is the magnitude of the problem. The fact that the people who were on the ground level, these guys weren't really drug dealers. They were just trying to eke out a living. And they, you know, there were these economic forces in play that most people just didn't understand at all.
Well, not to mention if they refused to grow the coca plant, there would be retaliation against them and their families. I mean, there's a major threat against them.
That's what I was going to ask about is, we know Colombia was violent. We know Mexico's violent, those places like that. How violent was it in Peru, considering that was the start of the stream? And actually what you're describing too, almost sounds like, we went to a wine tasting here a while back, actually had a kid out of Italy. His family has, you know, some vineyards. And it's amazing what you say, because the same grape grown in two different locations, that's like 300 meters apart because one's a little higher in altitude, different sun. The wine was completely different. I mean, it's amazing how little change in altitude or temperature or precipitation changes, you know, the makeup of this. But how violent were things, you know, in Peru?
Very. So you had the confluence of a couple of things. So you had the drug problem that I've discussed sort of in general terms. But then you also had a major insurgency going on, this organization called Sendero Luminoso, or the Shining Path, were very active in the Alto Huayaga Valley, and their claim to, or their complaint was that once you got outside of the capital, right, there were no services to the people, but the government really was very punitive in a lot of ways, and in some respects they weren't wrong, but it was a full blown armed struggle by the time we got there. In fact, it's a kind of a sad story, but not as funny as I thought it was once. But we're sitting down there in Tingo Maria before we built the base camp up in Santa Lucia, and it's this tourist hotel with corrugated metal, you know, porch, and kind of a lovely place. We're out having breakfast, and we get called that one of the patrols that we're working with had been ambushed, and we got to scramble. So we run across the street to the 64th Comandancia, jump on the helicopters, and go out. And you know, we get out there, and people are still dying. I mean, the engagement is over, but there are people who are still bleeding out, and the place had been shot up, and the patrol had been ambushed by Sendero Luminoso. And we end up coming back after many, many hours, and we're back in the same hotel, and we're sitting on the porch, and we're finally going to have a meal. And there's a big avocado tree out there, and an avocado hit that corrugated metal roof, and everybody jumps up. You know, we hadn't realized how tense we were, but we were ready to make 9mm guacamole. You know, it's this.
I've never had 9mm guacamole. I can only imagine.
It's heavy in lead.
It's crunchy. Yeah. But you know, think about that though too. It's like anything. I'll tell you, the area I live in out here, Murph, you know this too. You traitor's bastard until you moved. But a lot of law enforcement out here, but military and stuff. And there's some people have no awareness of their surroundings. Finally, had to have a discussion with the lawn service because they would wait. One of the neighbors out here uses them. They would wait till 7 o'clock in the morning, which is kind of the HOA rules. But then they would just let the trailer gate on that thing fall down, and it sounds like a frickin' either grenade going off or a gunshot going off. I finally went out and talked to him and said, by the way, my neighbor two doors up, Secret Service, Presidential Protective Detail, said, you may want to rethink about just letting that thing whack open and slam. So, but
did
I can
they
see
listen?
How, what's that?
Did they listen?
Yeah. This next time they showed up, my wife's going, I didn't hear it. It's good. Yeah.
Why would you go out there and talk to him with a shotgun in your hand? It makes a lot of difference, doesn't it?
Well, I was cleaning my AR-15 with my bandolero, you know, and all my ammo.
No. Absolutely.
Yeah, night vision goggles. But that's interesting. So let's talk about that. How does that wrap into then, was this guy that was your neighbor, what was he, like you say, was he involved in that part of the trade then? Was he running a lot of those operations?
He was. So Tito Lopez Paredes and another guy named Vaticano provided the key infrastructure to fly the coca paste from Peru into Colombia, where it was sold. And of course, the value jumped up exponentially the further you got it north on the ladder going up towards the U.S. I mean, these guys were not engaged in distribution of cocaine in the United States. They weren't even at the time really very active in the production of cocaine hydrochloride. It was simply like taking this commodity that was valuable and moving it to another place where it was even more valuable and making the vig on this stuff. And so
Smoking like a true mafia guy, making the vig. Hey, but yeah. how do you make a case against somebody who's taking product out of one country that the U.S. has no jurisdiction in, taking it to another country that the U.S. has no jurisdiction in, and that gets embedded into the product, you know, the paste? Is that part of a conspiracy? I mean, how do you go back and indict these folks? Do you have to prove certain kinds of knowledge? I'm saying this more for a lot of people because, you know, we did a deep dive on a lot of things, but this is one of the first times we've really done a deep dive around just the creation of it. I didn't realize it was 7 kilos of paste to make 1 kilo. Michelle may have said that, but you think about the number of people, how time intensive it is. By the time that kilo makes it to the United States, what's the markup on that for even for them to make, you know, money on it? So that's why I'm asking, how do you go about making a case against somebody who's only making the paste?
Yeah. So, it wasn't until much later, Congressman by the name of Henry Hyde, helped
New York, change, right?
Yeah, the Hyde Amendment basically gave us the tools to charge people who engaged in activity extraterritorially. But back in those days, in sort of the 87 timeframe when we were there, this was really more about trying to cripple the industry than it was to get them prosecuted in the U.S. And so this is where I really started doing a lot of work with the U.S. intelligence community. And what I can talk about still here is, we were intercepting communications. These people were based out in the jungles, and so there was a lot of communication that went over UHF radios, and some satellite phones were just starting to kind of come on board.
Sounds like Centrist Mike Murph a little bit, the First Capabilities Integration Group out of the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
That's all public knowledge, folks. Nothing classified there. That's you can find that on the interwebs.
Yeah, we worked with 7th Group Special Forces. We're based down there. There was it was an interesting cauldron of the alphabet soup down there, all trying to look at this problem from different vantage points.
Have to answer one question though. The chief of station for CIA, was it Bob, Paul, or Mike?
No, Joe.
Joe. And, there's a new one, Joe.
And Joe ended up leaving in a big problem just as I was getting down there. And then we ended up with sort of more enlightened leadership, let me just put it that way, where we ended up doing a lot more things together after that. But there were some there was quite a shakeup just as I got there. And I'm not sure that I still know all of the details, but I know enough of them to know that it was probably a good thing that he moved along. So
sounds familiar.
Yeah. So, but continue on from that. So, because that makes sense too. When you can't indict, create cases, then disruption. You've got to disrupt the supply chain.
And that's really what it was about. As we tried to focus in on something, you think about it. If you're trying to kill, I'm using an analogy here, obviously not literally kill, but if you're trying to kill somebody, right, you could starve them, it would take weeks. If you tried to sort of dehydrate them, and that would take days. But if you cut off the oxygen, right, they're dead in a matter of minutes. And so ultimately what that led us to was a strategy over there in the jungle where, there's no way that we can eradicate all of this cocaine, all of the coca that's being cultivated, even though State Department was dead set on this huge eradication effort. But where our focus was there are certain precursor chemicals that are necessary to take this leaf and convert it into a product that could then be shipped to move it over. And all of the products, all the precursor chemicals that you need to do that come from someplace else. There's none of it that was produced in the jungles themselves. So how do we identify, interdict, track this stuff, and try and cut off the lifeblood that was going out to these coca paste production facilities and the cocaine based laboratories. And as it turned out, the potassium permanganate, which they used to sort of filter and clean the coca and get it into shape where it could be transported in, because this is weight for value, right? They got to fly it out of the jungle. And one of the things that the State Department and others learned with the U.S. Agency for International Development trying to create alternative crops for these people to do something is, but the narcos bring in all the raw materials. They bring in the transportation network. They pay cash on the barrel head, and there's nothing else out there that can compete, right? So if you want to make it competitive to do some legitimate crop, then you have to drive up the cost of being engaged in the coca traffic. Part of that is exposing some people to risk of criminal prosecution, but that wasn't hugely likely just given the numbers and the odds and whatever else was out there. But we could drive up the cost by, take a thermite grenade and burn up their generators, crater their airstrips, blow up the laboratories, take shipments of precursor chemicals that were worth tens of thousands of dollars and blow them up. And while it, in the global scheme of things, it didn't affect a lot of people, at the bottom of the pyramid where people are still living hand to mouth, you take $10,000 of capital out of somebody's hands, you know, now all of a sudden growing macadamia nuts, you know, looks a little more attractive. And I don't have the police breathing down my neck and that sort of thing. So,
well, you mentioned that. You mentioned that you could use thermite grenades, and are you saying you did use thermite grenades in crater runways, or are you just talking hypothetically there, Chief?
Oh, no. No, we blew a lot of stuff up when we were down there.
Now, that had to be fun, though.
That was very fun. So, funny story about that. Again, I don't know why I end up in these little offices, but I was number eight in the Lima office when I get down there, an eight-man office. And at the time, Pete Reif is the country attaché. So Pete goes out for his last tour. He's been selected to move on, and we're going to have a new country attaché out there. And he goes out for his last operation in the jungle just as I'm getting down there. Now, my Spanish is nowhere near as good as it is today at the time, and I could barely find my way to the embassy from a parking lot where the DEA cars were parked. And he goes out with the head of the Guardia Civil, Juan Zarate Gambini, is the general in charge, right? And they're out cratering airstrips, right? They're blowing up these, selectively blowing up airstrips that have been used for drug offloads and then laying in ambush on other ones, waiting for the planes to come in. Anyway, they land in a, they see what looks like an offload going on near Tocachi. And they land the helicopter to dispatch some troops, but the helicopter's still loaded up with dynamite to crater the airstrips. And it gets hit by an RPG from the Sendero Luminoso guys in Tocachi, blows it up, kills the door gunner and the co-pilot, and Pete Reif and General Zarate and a bunch of others escape into the countryside. And so now I'm like one of four people in the office that's still there because it's summer and people had taken summer vacations, and I'm leading a rescue operation and I could barely find the embassy from the parking lot, right? And going across to try and bring these guys back. And, you know, long story short is they survive and we bring them back. And Pete Reif writes this cable. That's a whole different story. But General Zarate, the guy who's in charge, and I got to know each other then, and this really sort of set the tone for my law enforcement career later on. So I'm waiting over at their office to meet with one of the majors or something over there, and Zarate comes walking in and sees me. He says, "What are you doing waiting down here?" I said, "Well, I'm just here to see Major Molina." No, come on up with me, right? And so turns out he was very grateful that, you know, that we came in and saved him and brought him back. And So I'm asking to do something, and I'm, you know, it's not my country, so I'm being very polite. Says, "Tony, listen, to your friends, anything is possible. The rules, that's for somebody else." Right?
You gotta love it.
And at that point, a light bulb went off and said, "Wait a minute, personal relationships with these guys. I got it.
Yeah.
I can figure this out.
It's only taken me 7 years. Guy. Yeah, I'm figuring this out."
But and not to toot the DEA horn here, but I'm going to anyway. That's what I love about DEA. Here you are, you know, for lack of better words, you don't know your butt from a hole in the ground there because you're brand new in country, but you did what you had to do. And that, in my opinion, that's what separates us from some of the other agencies at times. When there's a crisis, you step up and you take care of business.
You know what I'm more shocked about this story is that RPG didn't set off the dynamite.
It did. It did. It blew up the helicopter.
I'm surprised then that they were in the air when that happened?
No. They had landed the helicopter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
On the runway in Tocachi because there was an offload. They saw a plane trying to offload cocaine onto the thing.
Oh, how did I miss that? I'm thinking if they survived a mid-air strike with an RPG, that's amazing.
No, the helicopter was on the ground, and there was a co-pilot and a door gunner still in it, and everybody else had left the helicopter to go pursue the trucks that were bringing the cocaine to this plane. And when the RPG hit, it did blow up the helicopter. The helicopter and the people who were unfortunate enough to still be in it are dead. dead and gone. And
So whatever happened with this kingpin, let's bring this to a close because I want to talk about Willie Falcone and the Magluta gut dudes.
Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately we learned that Vaticano is killed. He's brought to justice, not by the forces of law and order, but by his competitors, and is murdered in a sort of a drug deal gone bad between him and the Colombians out in the area of Iquitos, up on the border with Colombia. That's really what happens. And Tito López Paredes ultimately gets arrested and charged in Peru, but then that's a whole other mess. That's back in the days of Fujimori, and the case, gets botched up a bunch of ways. He spends a lot of time in pretrial detention, but then ultimately is released. So, and there's rumors as to whether money exchanged hands for the case to get botched and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have an opinion because I'm not close enough to the information, or wasn't close enough to the information to know what happened. But it was, to say that it was not an efficient above board system down there at the time would have been a gross understatement of the state of play.
And especially avocados as weapons too, man. I would have known you could have blown up an entire hotel throwing an avocado.
Headless and handless bodies, you're in the shower at the base camp and the water stops running. You come out and we had 17 headless and handless bodies floating down the Wayaga Valley that had got into the intakes for our showers. You're in the shower and the water ain't coming through. It's because there's dead bodies in the intakes. It was a crazy time.
Whew. Well,
there's something you don't hear every day.
Honey, the sink's clogged. Yeah, there's a reason why. but you go from this now, but you go from this kind of action now, the next post you get right is Miami. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I,
now you volunteered for this or did you get assigned?
No, I wanted to go to Miami. My whole goal in, going to Peru was to get to where the action was. And so, at the time they had this program where when you applied to get promoted to group supervisor, when you applied for one job, you applied for all of them, right? So I'm now I'm about 7 years on the job as a working agent. I've got a score that's competitive. And so I apply for a group supervisor job, but I'm rotating back from Peru. And I get selected for the Miami Field Division, which is what I volunteered for. So I'm thrilled. I'm going back to Miami. Well, I'm not going back. I'm going to Miami. And I show up. And the first thing that happens is they say, well, would you mind going to Fort Lauderdale instead of Miami? Well, Fort Lauderdale was pretty good because it still had four enforcement groups and a diversion group. And as it turned out, we did most of our work down in Dade County anyway, which is a source of some other issues. But
yes, it was. So
yeah. So, yeah, okay, fine. But then I no sooner get there, I guess I'm probably like 2 or 3 months in the Miami division, and I get notified, congratulations, you've been selected to be a group supervisor in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Oh my God, come on, you're kidding me, right?
That's where Michelle Linhart was at before before she came out. I mean, it's a lot of good things. Hey, my sister and brother-in-law live in Apple Valley, just outside Minnesota, eh? There's some good things up there, eh?
Any place where you got to live in like a hamster cage to keep from freezing to death in the wintertime is too cold for me. And, I did not want to go back to the Midwest.
You've already experienced lake effect snow. It was like, I'm done with this. Yeah.
So anyway, I was able to work a deal. My, the SAC down there, Tom Cash at the time, and my ASAC basically came to an agreement that, listen, he's got a competitive score. He's willing to stay here and not take the, I wasn't turning down a promotion, but I said, but if you'll consider me, for the next vacancy that comes available down here, I'd rather stay. You just paid to move all my stuff here. You paid the closing cost on my new house. I'm down here. My family's installed. I'll be a little bit patient, but I'm not turning down a promotion either, So as it turned out, about 7 or 8 months after I get to Miami, I get promoted to become a group supervisor, and I'm running Group 23 up in Fort Lauderdale. So, I went to Fort Lauderdale as a working agent, and now I'm running a group. And
what happens if you turn down a promotion? What does that do for you? Do you ever get promoted, or does it just put you out like 2 years or something?
It makes it a lot harder. So there's a career board that I sat on for a lot of years afterwards. And there's a, I'll just say when I was there for 7 or 8 years, I was on the career board. There was a prevailing view, that if you really want to be a manager in DEA, then you had to be mobile. Right. Yeah. And if you're turning down because it wasn't your particular assignment, then maybe you didn't have the stuff to be a DEA manager, because the idea was once you got promoted, you became an agency resource and they were going to move you where they needed you. And that certainly was the case with me.
The needs mm-hmm. of the service, the needs of the agency.
What year did you get to Lauderdale?
I got there in July of 1990. Lou Perry was the ASAC at the time. Yeah. And then Joe Salvamini came in after that to run the Fort Lauderdale district office.
Did you, and you mentioned Jay Gregorius earlier, were he and Harry Summers in your group?
So I was originally in Lou Farrow's group over in Group 22. And when I took over Group 23, Jay worked for me. Okay. Harry was in Group 22. Jay was in 23 with me. And I had a whole wrecking crew of guys over there, including Dave Bora, who had the Falcone Magluta case.
So I'm thinking that there's some overlap here, Murph, right? Because when were you down in Miami?
87 to 91. And that's how I got to know Harry and Jay, who end up being, lifelong friends. But, initially it's like, shit, here comes Fort Lauderdale again, screwing up our cases in Dade County.
that's why I wanted to get into it. You had that thing. Yeah, I know. You guys, you Fort Lauderdale people, come down here.
But those were two outstanding investigators. Both made at SESs and DEA and are retired and going on to better things, bigger and better things now.
Well, let's talk about this in Miami, because there are a couple famous names. Like you said, you now are the manager. You're the group soup. You're responsible, but you have to watch what goes on, build the case. And there's stuff that you say was made for TV. It was made for TV. We're talking about Willie Falcone and the Magluta brothers. I mean, just their display of wealth was so. The word is ostentatious, Murph. That means like really like in your face. Sometimes you have to explain.
Here's that sign again. You know what that means?
Anything more than two syllables, we got to define for Murph.
Get a double.
Yeah. One of their biggest mistakes was just being so flagrant with their wealth, with the boats and everything else. So let's talk about this. How did you end up, because overall you're managing what goes on. Yeah. I mean, you're not day to day doing the work, but I mean, you're seeing everything that's going on. Tell us about the evolution of this case.
Yeah. So, I come in and the Isle of Man cases is just starting to wrap up, and that's a guy named Melvin Kessler who was laundering a bunch of money. And as a result of that case, they develop an informant. So Magluta and Falcone had been well-known, household names. Anybody, it's kind of like the Nicky Barnes of New York, right? Everybody's got some kind of claim to Falcone and Magluta. I did this, I did that. But nobody ever was able to build the case against these guys. And so we developed in Group 23 this informant in the Melvin Kessler Isle of Man cases that puts us ultimately into this guy Peggy, who is the one of the Falcone Magluta's biggest guys, and we flip this guy and start building a historical conspiracy case. So our work is not really chasing these guys down in real time while they're, running loads with fast boats, from South America into South Florida, but it's rather like taking this insider story and then gathering up documentary evidence and all kinds of other wiretaps and things that have been done, and try and put together the pieces so that we could show that there was this ongoing con- continuing criminal enterprise and a conspiracy and agreement among and between people to engage in this criminal activity and then link it with the seizures that had actually happened and the rest to prove the case. So it's largely a paper case to do. And this is all going on at the background while we've got a million other cases going at the same time. So basically had one agent who was working this case full time, a guy named Dave Bora. And then the case becomes so big, we do some document search warrants. The Fort Lauderdale District Office had one evidence room for the entire district. So three enforcement groups, a diversion group, and the West Palm Beach Resident Office had one room for all the evidence there. And then we had one room for this case because we ended up doing search warrants and we had like 400,000 documents that we got on search warrants and a bunch of other things that needed to now be gone through. And
in those days, before you had all this technology like scanning, you know, optical character recognition, be able to digitize everything, how did you handle? I mean, I'm thinking back, you're thinking back going, geez, 20 years old, I'm handling all of this evidence. Here I am again, going through papers and documents and everything.
So that was right at the front end of optical character recognition. And we were one of the first cases where they actually did that. They came in and bait stamped all the documents and scanned them in. And it was a far cry from what you have today, but we did get some document management in there, but just trying to keep track of all this evidence and then interviewing the witnesses. But the case really gets interesting when we start flipping a couple of people, and now it becomes known that, hey, this is more than just sort of passing interest. Somebody is like really dialing down on us. And all of a sudden, our witnesses, we had over the course of the investigation, 7 witnesses murdered, right? You know, you had Lazaro Diaz, he's taking his kid to school, and he's driving his kid to school, and the tire on his car, they'd let the air out, goes flat. So he's got his car up on jacks, changing the tire, and they drive by and machine gun him to death. You know, changing the tire on his car. Bernie Gonzalez, you know, his car gets blown up in a garage in Miami. You know, it was the kind of stuff you think that they would be making up, and it was over dramatized on TV, but it was happening in real life. And then, you know, I talked about like the differences in the amount of crime. So we took this dry conspiracy, well, not a dry conspiracy. We took a historical conspiracy that had a bunch of existing seizures, developed a bunch of witnesses, and then we turned it into a proactive case. And we went to a residence in Coconut Creek, Florida, and took 3,800 kilos of cocaine out of the rafters of a house in Coconut Creek that belonged to Falcone and Magluta.
Hey, you know, Tony, real quick, before we dive into that, go back to the witness for a second. How were they identifying the witnesses? Because, you know, most of the time you're trying to keep this stuff, you know, on the QT. You don't want anybody to know. Was there any kind of a leak or was there a bribery? I mean, I'm not saying that there was. I'm just saying, how did they, just through the way they found out, how did they go about finding out about these witnesses and having them whacked?
Well, at one point, the defense attorneys, so they had, it was, this is further along down in the case, but the defense attorneys were some of the finest criminal defense attorneys, not fine people, but effective criminal defense attorneys. As Tom Cash used to say, you got criminal attorneys and attorney criminals. And these guys were a mix of both, right? But the... They took the list of all the people that we were talking to and they published it in a newsletter that they sent out to all the prisons and basically said, you know, DEA is trying to look for these people. Do you know anything about, you know? And so they themselves, the criminal defense bar, published the names of all the people that they had gotten from pretrial discovery to everybody out there and sort of put it into the world that these people were cooperating in our case. And that basically made it much harder for us to prove who actually was killing these people as they're going through. But they had smuggled cell phones and at one point a weapon into MCC Miami in this case. It's just it was insanity. It was a made-for-TV motion picture.
So these attorneys published the witnesses because they know exactly. I mean, you know what's going to happen. You're dealing with Magluta, Falcone. You put a name out there, you've just marked them.
Oh, absolutely. There was no question about this. And I mean, it's just one more of the elements in this case. I mean, it as it turns out, we did a six-month trial. So we end up locating Magluta and Falcone. We working with the U.S. Marshal Service, pin them down. LaGorsch Island out in Biscayne Bay is where Magluta was. And then Falcone was over on Star Island, both in these like fancy houses, but with, you know, open water access and boats. And we locked these guys up. So we go in there just as sort of an aside. You talk about ostentatious wealth, right? We go in to do the search warrant, and there was kilo ingots of solid gold that were strewn around the house as paperweights to keep the papers from blowing away with the fans. His wife's travel jewelry, just like, you know, Alina didn't stay there that often, but her travel jewelry was worth more than $500,000, her little travel bag. They had, you know, when all was said and done, they owned condo buildings, not condominiums, but buildings that had condominiums in them, factories where they made the go-fast boats, as well as the go-fast boats, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles, right? It was crazy, the staggering amount of money. And then they owned a place called the Bell Gardens Bicycle Club and Card Casino in California. And we ended up, while the Marshal Service ran it, I was getting a check for $500,000 a month as our proceeds from running the place while the forfeiture action was going on. So I think our group took credit, you know, in the forfeiture stats for about $7 million to run the place before we actually sold it for, you know.
I could just see DA administration going, hey, we don't need to close this case yet. I think maybe there's a couple other things we got to do. Hey, daddy needs a new car. You know, we got to do some training here. Oh, my God. But see, that's the interesting thing, too. Yeah, you guys are now taking over an operation and running it, and that becomes a very – how many other agencies can lay claim to the fact is that you are revenue – not only revenue neutral, but you make money for the government far more than what it costs to operate you.
Only IRS. No,
so we were talking about Jay Gregorius before. Jay, when he's working for me, did a case on a guy named Mandy Fernandez in Miami. And there's a place, I think it's still there on Bird Road in Miami, called The Collection. And they did Porsche, Ferrari, and they're all high dollar vehicles. We take down the case and we seize the dealership, and we're running the dealership for a while, and of course, everybody had to sort of test drive the cars.
Oh, sure. I can just see you out there, one of you guys going, hey, what do I got to do to put you into a Porsche today? Help me help you, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, good times and fun. And the beauty of being in a place like Miami is, you know, the work was just as dangerous as it was in Cleveland or someplace else, but you're operating at a different scale, right? These were now transnational drug traffickers. So Magluta and Falcone, as it turns out, Jimmy Capper and I connect back in those days, and there was a seizure in Sylmar, California out there. See if I can get this right. It was 10,000 kilos of cocaine and $8 million in a storage place out there.
Protected by a single master lock. We had Jimmy on to talk about the case. Everything, yeah. You got all of the stuff, and it's got a master lock. That's the only protection it's got on the frickin' door.
Well, and that's Willie. We figured out that was Willie Falcone and Sal Magluta's dope out there. And you know, that was. So, yeah, I mean, and that's the other thing is this, as competitive as people can be about my case. I think what I've seen over the years is the progression of an organization that was all about who's going to get the credit to one where collaboration and like we can all make everybody's cases better if we'll sit down and work this out and sort of the SOD story and, you know, coordinating among and between, you know, it's the story of the the two bulls standing up on a hill. There's an old bull and a young bull. And
I've told this one before.
All the cows, you know, let's run down there and have sex with one of those cows. And the older bull says, let's walk and we'll take them all.
That's right. That's Kansas farm boy logic. Let's slow down, Skippy. We got time here. Yeah. And we also did an episode too with Derek Maltz. We had Derek on, you know.
Yeah.
What fun. Well, hey, so
collected.
Yeah. So what are you doing now? What keeps you busy these days?
I'm mostly retired now. After I retired from DEA in 2010, I did about 3.5 years with consultancy, Booz Allen Hamilton, which is a really good company, but I realized I really didn't like consulting. And I get a phone call from a friend of mine from the British embassy, who's, you know, sort of my equivalent in the British embassy, and he calls and says, hey, mate, I don't know if you heard, but this British bank, HSBC, got in trouble with the Department of Justice. And
a little bit of money laundering, yeah.
$2 billion fine. Anyway, they're hiring me to help build this government relations thing, and I'm looking for somebody in the U.S. to, you know, engage. He said, do you know anybody? I said, yeah, me. I'm tired of this consulting thing. So I ended up going to work for them, and my work on the government engagement side was really kind of short-lived. The guy who had previously ended up running FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and then OFAC, the sanctions piece of the U.S. government, Bob Werner, had gone to work for HSBC as well. And I get a call from Bob who tells us that the government monitor, you know, who is overlooking this thing, had gone back to Mexico, which was ground zero for the deferred prosecution agreement, had done another inspection, and the bank in Mexico just was not making enough progress. And it was at the point where the global CEO from HSBC was ready to sell the Mexican franchise of the bank and just be done with it. So Werner calls me and says, you served it in Mexico with DEA, right? I said, yeah. You still speak Spanish? Yeah. He says, I need you to go pack your bags. This is another one of those, you know, like, I need you to just sort of help us out. Well, 6 years later, I came back, right? It was go down and rebuild all of the internal controls for the bank, you know, around money laundering and sanctions evasion. And to be fair, they did get some enlightened leadership in there, and it was a real job. It was a hard job, but I was dealing with, you know, I was on speed dial with the board of directors and dealt with CEOs of the various entities down there in Latin America on a daily basis, and, you know, I feel like I did some good. And you know, ironically, in a city of 20 million people, the bank and the embassy are separated by two blocks, so I'm eating in the same restaurants with the same waiters that had been there, you know, 10 years earlier.
Hey, we know you.
Yeah,
bienvenidos, right. Amigo.
What? Bienvenidos. Welcome back. Welcome back, sir. We have your table for you over here.
Yeah. And then most recently, I, you know, in 2022, the pandemic is sort of reaches its point, and the bank is already out from under the DPA. The board of directors had asked me to stay on and actually manage the program for a couple of years after they did it to make sure they stayed out of trouble, which is fine. But by the end of 2022, we had come to a mutual agreement. They didn't want to pay the extraordinary sums they had to pay to keep an expat down there anymore. And I didn't want to stay in Mexico on a local contract. So I came back. And then, you know, this little thing called Live Golf started up, and I got asked to come down and run security for their tournament down in Mayakoba this past year. And I was telling Murph before we started that, you know, after 11, 16-hour days in a row to try and, like, herd the cats on this thing, I said, you know what, there's a reason why I'm retired. I don't mind working hard, but, like, 11, 16-hour days, they're running me ragged here. This is enough.
Life's too short, man.
Yeah.
Death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. Well, that was an interesting story too, because now with Liv Golf and PGA, and what is it called, DRP or the other?
That's the European Tour.
European, right? Yeah. Wow. Well, man, I'll tell you what.
He's got a busy schedule now. He's, you know, you got the tag group, the Ashburn group there in Northern Virginia that gets to lunch there and goes to lunch every month. You know, you got a plan for that. I still get the emails for that.
Yeah. I still play in a men's golf league and get some kayaking in. And my wife and I have taken it up hiking. You know, I did a lot of hiking on the Appalachian Trail as a kid, but my wife got it in mind that we should do 52 hikes or average one a year, one a week over the course of a year. And we knocked that out in 2022. We got in, I think it was 54 or 55 hikes then. And
wow,
this year we're going to take on the 4,000 footers up in New Hampshire, I hope, this summer. So
New Hampshire.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm a Massachusetts boy, so I got to go back, you know.
You got to go back to this Commonwealth of Taxachusetts. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
first of all, this is us, people can't see this, us saluting you. Thank you for the work that you did protecting this great country, man. We have to dive into one of these other stories later again, because there's so much to unpack, even with Falcon and Magluta and all the stuff they did and the stuff you were doing, even down in Mexico and stuff like that. We're going to have to revisit this, Murph. You're going to have to get on it and start rescheduling some of these people, or I'm going to have to demote you.
Well, with Tony, I mean, we didn't even get in. You were the sack of New York City there for a while, right? With DEA.
Yeah, no, that was in many ways the high point of my career. I did not want to leave, and at many points in my career, you know, I was not a volunteer. I was voluntold that I was being transferred and promoted, or
and then to take over the head of the head of DEA intel and you know, meeting on a regular basis with the director of national intelligence and all the intel other agencies, and brought DEA actually into the intel community. I mean, he's got so many more stories that we haven't even touched on today. We might have to bring you back, Tony.
We're going to have to do this in a skiff too, so we'll have to.
Some of the stories are actually true too.
Seriously, this is us saluting you. I know we got more stories. We're going to have you back. So, Murph, you're on the hook now. Reschedule or schedule another one. We'll get another set of stories out of you. Mr. Truman,
but you can't see, Tony. I have the master list up here, brother, and you were on there again. Sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, it's been fun. I really enjoyed it. Morgan, Murph, it's thanks for what you're doing, and it's been a fun trip down memory lane.
Yeah. All we do is we tell stories of, like, you tell the story, we just simply host you. So we thank you.
Absolutely. Honor to have you on here, Tony. Thank you very much. Good to see you again, brother.
All right. Don't go anywhere, Tony or Murph. Everybody hold on, and the rest of you guys stay tuned for the debrief. Told you, Murph. That is one intelligent dude working in intelligence, you know, but he apparently wasn't on your selection board.
Actually, I think, when you get promoted to SES, it's up to the administrator. They probably did talk to Tony. This is a guy, though. It was like, remember we had Jimmy Capper on here?
Yep.
He was chief of domestic operations in DEA headquarters. This is a guy that, you know, we've had some challenging administrators in the Drug Enforcement Administration. Most don't come up through the ranks. Most are appointed by the Attorney General or the President. Actually, they're appointed by the President. The Attorney General oversees them. But they're the kind of guys that they go in and they get their butts chewed out by, you know, we call administrators temp employees, because they come and go with as the presidential administration changes. And they get their butts chewed, and then they'll come to an all-hands meeting with a smile on their face, and you'll never know what just happened. Because they see that's their job to take that. It's not your job to have to suffer from that. So Tony's one of those guys. Just have the utmost respect. We didn't talk about his life after DEA, but he was in high demand internationally. And I think now he told us he's enjoying doing some hiking with his wife. Looks like he's in great shape. Just an honor to have the man on here. So, Tony, thank you, brother. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Tony Placido.
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 Tony, he doesn't live that far from you. He's in Ashburn. You're in Chantilly.
Just listen to the episode. Anyway, guys, we hope you enjoyed that. Hit those 5 stars. Go to over to Apple and Spotify. We don't, it's magic. We don't know how it works, but it does. Hey guys, as we told you maybe last time, but Stitcher is going away. So if you're listening on Stitcher, transition to another platform, Apple, Spotify, you know, you name it, iHeartRadio, whatever it is you listen to, Amazon. But Stitcher will be going away, I believe, in August or September. So make that transition now. Head on over to Game of Crimes Podcast for more information about the show. We'll update it as we go along, our as we have merch, as we add more books and stuff. Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also hit our Game of Crimes fans page run by Sandy Salvato with the Velvet Glove. Just answer a couple questions, get in there. But also just got to go to Patreon, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. We've got our Q&A coming out, which will be out on the 10th. We've got You Can't Make This Shit Up, which comes out mid-month. We've got all sorts of different things, different stuff for different people. And Murph, I don't know if I told you this, but we had some people ask, but we will be starting in August for you Patreon folks. If you are at the Warden of the Throne level, you're going to get access to all of our episodes without commercials.
Hey, so cool.
We're going to be releasing that. So you get episode. And then if you are at Guardian of the Realm, which is our second highest level, you get every other episode without commercials. So we wanted to find a way to differentiate from those people. We enjoy all your support, but the more you support us, the more we do for you. So that's the way we'll be doing it. If you're at Evil is Coming, you might want to think about upgrading to Guardian of the Realm. You know,
there you go. It's, you know, it's amazing. We go out on these speaking tours and I'm just shocked at how many people come up and say, I love your show. Or I'll get a text message or I'll get an email or an Instagram or, you know, all that social media junk that I don't know a whole lot about. But thank you so much for your support. It keeps us motivated. It keeps us moving forward here. And we just got some guests that come in that. Well, I think we're going to knock your socks off this year.
As soon as we get one in the bank, I was telling Murph, as soon as we get it recorded and done, and I know we have it, then we've got something really special we're going to tell you about. So, that being said, let's bring this to a close, Murph, and we want to tell everybody, thank you for being listening to us. Thank you if you're a Patreon member. If not, go join patreon.com/gamercrimes. But the biggest thank of all, thank you, folks, to our players out there. Thank you for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.